This episode contains graphic descriptions of crime scenes, which may be disturbing to some listeners.
Today we're bringing you the story of the brutal murder of a well-known and celebrated actor from the 1970s. Some would say this case has been solved, and maybe that's because police believe they had the killer. But even though their suspect was prosecuted and found not guilty, some argue that the real killer was never identified. So the question remains, who killed Bob Crane?
This is APB Cold Case. Here's your host, former police chief Mark Spahn.
Our story begins on June 28, 1978, in beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. That evening, 49-year-old actor Bob Crane leaves the guest condo on East Chaparral where he's staying, and he drives over to the Windmill Dinner Theater, where he performs that night in a play called Beginner's Luck.
Afterwards, Bob goes out into the lobby, as he always did. Bob loved his fans.
That was Carol Ford, author of the book Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography, which encompasses 12 years of research and investigation.
He goes out into the lobby and he signs autographs, and he's out there for an hour, you know, however long it takes. People come up to him, he signs autographs, he loves his fans.
But someone else is waiting for Bob, a man by the name of John Henry Carpenter, who Bob had previously met and befriended over their shared interest in video cameras.
They became friends. They were not by any stretch of the imagination best friends, but they were friends, and John was more or less a hanger-on. And so after Bob is finished signing autographs in the lobby of the Windmill Dinner Theater, he and John Carpenter go out back to where the car is parked, and they notice that there is a flat tire.
Bob gets the tire repaired, and the two men decide to go to dinner at a restaurant called Bobby McGee's in Scottsdale. After dinner, they go back to the condo where Bob's staying. John Carpenter leaves, and Bob goes to sleep. The following day, June 28, 1978, Bob misses a morning appointment with a colleague named Victoria Berry Wells. He's also a no-show at a scheduled luncheon. Victoria finds it odd that Bob not only missed their appointment, but she still hadn't heard from him. So she goes over to the condo.
Victoria Berry Wells finds that the door is unlocked. She is surprised, but she lets herself in. It's completely dark. She's calling his name, and she goes to the back bedroom. She's looking for him, doesn't know where he is, and she sees somebody lying in bed. She thinks it's a woman because of what she thinks is long hair that is fanned out on the pillows and the bed sheets. She realizes that this person is deceased. And at that point, that is when she calls 911.
Scottsdale police get that call at 2:20 p.m., and they respond to the scene. But the victim they find deceased on the bed is not a woman, it's Bob Crane. The autopsy report indicates that Crane suffered a blunt force injury behind his left ear with abundant blood on the body and head. The report listed scalp lacerations and a depressed skull fracture with deep contusions of the brain and minimal aspiration of blood into the lungs, indicating that he was very likely dead soon after being struck. And there's an electrical cord tied into a bow around his neck. One published report quoted police saying, "It was put on after he was dead, but it was put on tight." Carol talks about that strange bow and another finding at the crime scene. Something suspicious found on Bob's leg.
The bow tie was very symbolic. What was also very symbolic is on Bob's thigh, what they described as a white flaky substance. Now, this again is before DNA testing. This is before, you know, they really had the ways to determine what that white flaky substance could have been. It was assumed that it could have been from a man who had pleasured himself after the murder had been committed.
Linda Groundwater is also co-author of the Crane biography, with a background in freelance writing and journalism. She said there was no forced entry into Bob's room. She describes the crime scene.
Bob was known to be a very, very light sleeper, and Bob was killed in his sleep. So when Victoria went into the room and saw what she thought was that long, dark hair, she was actually looking at blood. But Bob was lying on his side with his hands tucked under his head. He was lying in the fetal position in a pair of boxers on top of his sheets. So whoever it was either comfortable being with Bob in that place or came in to a point where he would have just gone to sleep with them there, or they were so knowledgeable about Bob's, you know, habits that being there did not wake him up.
Linda said there was police video taken at the crime scene, and she says it reveals that the investigation was mishandled.
They let people walk in and out without taking any protection. They let them pick up the phone. They let them take things out of the condominium. They let people smoke in there. If you look at the crime scene video, you will see that the medical examiner actually crawls on top of the bed with Bob still in it and starts to manipulate the body and do things with the body before Bob has ever been removed from the room.
So the video shot by police certainly raises some eyebrows, but that won't be the only scandalous video connected to the crime scene. We'll come back to that later. For now, I want to talk about how Bob died. The autopsy report indicates that Bob Crane's cause of death was a blunt force head injury. The manner of death was homicide. Linda told me that it's believed he was struck with a piece of video equipment that came from within the room.
Because of the positioning of the body, Bob had been hit twice with what they believe was a camera tripod. They have not found the murder weapon, but something was wiped on the bed in blood on the sheets, and it appears to have been the outline of a camera tripod. So he was hit once in the back of the left ear. Great, great force. There was much blood all over this room, not just on Bob and the bed sheets and the pillow, but on the wall, on the ceiling, over on the side, on his diaries. There was a lot of blood everywhere.
Early published reports indicated the weapon may have been a tire iron or jack handle, but later theories honed in on the camera tripod. So who would want Bob Crane dead? To answer that question, we need to know more about him, and there's a lot to know.
Bob was born in Connecticut. He was born in Waterbury, Connecticut. He grew up in Stamford, Connecticut. He had one older brother. But what was really big for Bob was he was a drummer at a very young age, and he loved drums.
His love of drums is what got him into his radio career, which started a few years after he graduated from high school in 1946. It was about the same time that he met his first wife, Ann, who he married in 1949. Bob caught a big break when he was hired by KNX Radio in Hollywood in 1956. Here's Carol Ford.
And this is where his radio career explodes, because he is at KNX doing things in radio that had rarely, if ever, been done before. But he also had a component to his KNX radio show that allowed him to interview celebrities. So all the A-listers of the day, whether they were actors, actresses, musicians, authors, you know, pretty much anybody in the entertainment business. And this gets him his foot in the door to then, after 5 years at KNX, he starts acting.
Carol said that Bob got work on the Dick Van Dyke and Donna Reed shows. And then he gets a call about a new show.
He auditions for Hogan's Heroes, and he is selected for the role of Colonel Hogan. That's where he becomes known nationally. From there, of course, Hogan's Heroes is a tremendous success. It runs for 6 seasons. After Hogan's Heroes is canceled, he does some other bit part acting. He does some guest starring on various television shows. And he is also traveling across the country and doing dinner theater.
He has a busy career, but he also has a busy personal life. Bob and his first wife, Ann, had 3 children. Robert David, Debbie, and Karen. They would eventually divorce, and in 1971, Bob marries Patricia Olson. She's also an actor. She played Hilda on Hogan's Heroes alongside Bob. Together, they have a son named Robert Scott Crane. But Bob's hiding a secret, and at that time in history, it's a big one. The curtain isn't raised on Bob's sex addiction until after his death, but it becomes tabloid fodder, causing wild speculation about his murder Here's Linda Groundwater.
Realistically, Bob's sexual activity began when he was still living in Connecticut, outside of his marriage, I mean, of course. Bob would flirt a lot with women. He didn't mean anything by it, but he'd talk and talk, and, you know, he was very charming, and he had a lot of charisma. And so it wasn't just Bob came to Hollywood and Hollywood turned the good boy bad, which is how it was often perceived, because Bob was a conservative, Catholic, Irish, Russian, you know, man, you know, three kids in a station wagon. And that's what he was. But the other side of Bob was this undercurrent of addiction. It started out as just, let's see what happens, and became a full-blown addiction, just like any other addiction. But Bob had sex with literally hundreds of women. And for people who say, you know, addiction is just a word for an excuse to cheat on your wife, that's what happens when you have one or two affairs, not when you have sex with 100 or 200 women. That's something else altogether. And Bob was doing that.
Bob also had a fascination with photography and video, and he reportedly recorded many parts of his life. Again, here's Linda Groundwater.
Now, the other side of that is that Bob was a huge photography buff, loved the idea of film, and he was very OCD. So Bob filmed and recorded everything in his life, everything. Dinner conversations, dental appointments, changes to dental appointments. I mean, there are diary notes that said, you know, dentist 2 o'clock. And if it's crossed out and says move to Thursday, 1 o'clock, because dentist said such and such, like there was no just let me cross it off and move it. He had to record everything. There was something about his personality that said, I must chronicle everything in my life. Well, if sex is part of your life, then he would also film that part of his life. So although the main focus, of course, of what happened when Bob died was that people saw all the sex films, and because that was his big addiction at that time, they found a lot of sex films and whatnot around him, but there was also rooms of other film, rooms of other photos and other writings. There was everything in his life, and the sex might have made up 5%. But he was with woman after woman after woman after woman.
Could Bob's sex addiction have played a role in his death? Could the motive for his murder be jealousy?
There was, of course, the thought that it might have been one of the women he slept with. But again, chances are it wasn't one of those. That there was a jealous husband, potentially, or the husband of Victoria Berry Wells. But again, no particular evidence of that, although it certainly couldn't be ruled out.
Of the several names that have been raised over the years in this case, Carol says that none appear to be a woman.
Forensically, they determined fairly early on that because of the way that the blood spatter was in the room and on the wall, that a woman had been ruled out as being the person who committed the crime.
Another potential motive involves a certain black bag that Bob had, a bag suspected to contain photographs of prominent people. According to an article in the Yuma Sun newspaper, the black bag allegedly contained, quote, an album of pornographic stills.
They don't know where that went. It disappeared. Whoever killed Bob likely took it with them. Nobody knows what was in it. Nobody knows why it went missing. It is suspected that there were the photographs in there, but nobody really knows. It might have been John Carpenter who said it was missing. But those who had been with Bob knew he had this black bag. It was something that he had with him. You know, he carried it with him. And during the investigation, it was not there. It was not where it should have been. So it was never found. It was never located. Whoever took it, it's assumed that the killer took it. But even then, we don't know that either.
There's been a lot of speculation over the years about others who may have had a motive to kill Bob. In speaking with Carol and Linda about the list of suspects or theories, they told me that some have pointed to Bob's second wife, but she had an ironclad alibi. Some suggest she may have solicited someone to kill Bob. Again, Linda said she's seen no evidence to support that. Then, there's another more sinister theory. A mafia hit.
Because it was in Scottsdale, there was talk that perhaps it was a mob hit. Bob did talk about Scottsdale being a mob town. He actually mentioned this two or three times to people that he was with or speaking to while he was there. But the very personal nature of the murder seemed to rule that out. Somebody obviously hung around, because the understanding is that if you're doing this as a mob hit, you're not going to just use whatever weapon happens to be there. You're going to walk in with a plan.
If you're going to do a mob hit, you're going to go in, you're going to use a gun, most likely, and go in, shoot, boom, out. We've all seen The Godfather. We don't hang around, you know, we're out of there. Make sure the job is done and leave.
There's been a lot of speculation in this case and several theories. Here's Carol Ford.
You know, that's kind of what the rumblings have been, whether it's Bob's son, Robert, or if it's social media, you know, armchair detectives, you know, throwing things out. There could be somebody else out there that nobody knows. But whatever it is, this crime is done by someone who has such a deep-seated hatred of Bob, to the point that not only does it, you know, it's personal. He has to get close. He has to stand over him in the bed, holding a camera tripod, and get very close to him. Bob could wake up. Bob could wake up at any minute, and they could get into a real scrappy fight. And then after that's done, he plays with the body.
We've already talked about jealousy, but could the motive have been revenge for cutting someone out of Bob's inner circle? Could it have been to retrieve the black bag containing all sorts of photographs, something that could be embarrassing to someone? Or maybe a boyfriend or husband of one of Bob's female acquaintances? Here's Linda Groundwater.
It was Bob's oldest son who said, I believe, you know, he was a very, very light sleeper. It had to be somebody he was comfortable with or who was already there so that Bob was comfortable enough to go to sleep.
The investigation kept coming back to one suspect, John Henry Carpenter.
He was a Sony salesman, so he had access to a lot of the video parts. People think that he was like the man behind all of the technological things that, you know, Bob wasn't able to do, where actually he just supplied Bob with the parts for the cameras. And Bob was actually the one who was very mechanically inclined and was able to do, you know, all of the fixing and the work on the video cameras and whatnot. He would go and carouse with Bob in all of these different cities around the country looking for women. And Bob would get first dibs, and he would get, you know, whoever Bob didn't want.
It was alleged that there was an argument between the two men while having dinner that night at Bobby McGee's.
It is assumed that at that time, Bob was telling John Carpenter that he was going to no longer be hanging out with him, that he was breaking away from this type of lifestyle, going to clean up his act, and he no longer wanted to be a part of this type of scene.
The brutality of the crime was suggesting something.
This is somebody who had a very, very deep hatred for Bob Crane. Who is that person? Is it John Carpenter? Because Bob says, well, I'm not going to hang around you anymore. The other thought that floated around was that Bob and John Carpenter had a homosexual relationship, and that John Carpenter was, you know, grief-stricken over the fact that, you know, Bob was breaking up with him. Well, you know, whatever John Carpenter may have done in his life, Bob Crane was straight, and he was with women only. And Does John Carpenter feel that he's breaking up with him? Was there hope that he maybe would have wanted to be with? Who knows? You know, does that add to that theory?
Linda told us why she thinks police quickly focused on Carpenter as their suspect.
They focused in on John Henry Carpenter because he was with Bob last night, and that's the guy. And that's it. They never looked elsewhere.
Now, John Henry Carpenter is, and always has been, the law enforcement's prime suspect. He is the one that they became laser focused on right out of the gate.
So let's recap that night. After Bob's performance at the Windmill Dinner Theater, he and John Carpenter go out to the parking lot where they find the car has a flat tire. The tire's fixed, and they drive to Bobby McGee's restaurant in Scottsdale. When police follow up at that location, they learn something interesting about Bob and John.
It was reported from a waitress and from others that there was a heated discussion. They do not know what was said, but it wasn't a friendly type of an exchange. It was more stern, not a pleasant experience for either of them.
Police questioned John Carpenter about his account of events when both men returned to the condo on Chaparral Drive. Again, here's Carol.
And they go inside. At that point, Bob has a phone call with his wife, Patricia Olson. They are now separated. They have what John Carpenter claimed was an argument on the phone. There's a lot to be said about that as well, but Bob is yelling. He yells in the apartment, and to the point where the neighbors say he's yelling so loudly, he's not going to be able to perform tomorrow. He's going to get a sore throat. He's going to ruin his vocal cords. He's not going to be able to perform. That call ends. John Carpenter leaves. He goes back to his hotel room because he usually stayed in a hotel nearby where Bob was staying. He did not stay with Bob, but he stayed in his own hotel room. And then Bob goes to sleep.
From the evidence, we know that Bob was murdered in his bed. So either he went to sleep alone in the apartment and the killer came in through an unlocked door, or the killer was already inside the apartment when he fell asleep. Someone he was comfortable turning his back on. In either case, that person wanted him dead. And that somebody knows what really happened inside the apartment that night. Who is it? The answer is elusive, or at least it appears to be. Years pass without any significant updates in the case. One news report said that two previous prosecutors declined to go after Carpenter. The case goes cold. But Carol said that after a book by Robert Gray Smith came out titled The Murder of Bob Crane, Scottsdale police took another look at the case.
And they found a photograph with what they believed was a speck of brain matter in John Carpenter's rental car. They didn't have the actual specimen, you might say. Wherever it wasn't where it should have been with all of the evidence. And they take this photograph and they blow it up, they magnify it a million times, and they look at it and they say, yep, that's got to be Bob Crane's brain, pieces of his brain matter. So they feel at that time that they have enough evidence to take John Carpenter to trial. They arrest him and they take him to trial. And of course, you can't determine from a grainy 1978 photograph something that could be a piece of Bob's brain matter. It could be, I mean, you're talking a 1978 rental car.
According to the Kenosha News, John Henry Carpenter was arrested on June 1, 1992 for the murder of Bob Crane, then 14 years after his body was found in Scottsdale. The prosecutor at the time was vague about the new evidence, but the news report said the criminal complaint detailed that human tissue, possibly brain matter, was found on the passenger side door of Carpenter's rented car. In another article in the Kenosha News, they described smears of blood on the door of Carpenter's rental car, said to be type B, which was Crane's type. Carpenter reportedly had type A. At the time of Crane's murder in 1978, there was no such thing as forensic DNA testing. And even as they prepared for trial in 1992, DNA science had emerged, but required a more pristine sample than what science can identify today. The report from 92 said that genetic testing was inconclusive. At trial in 1994, the prosecution argued that Carpenter had motive, saying that Crane was ending their relationship and cutting off Carpenter's access to women attracted by Crane's fame. The prosecution's case was described as circumstantial, refuted by the defense that alleged the prosecution was exploiting the sexual aspects of the relationship and referring to a videotape that was apparently presented at trial showing Crane and Carpenter having sex with the same woman. That same news report also indicated that the woman who found Crane's body, identified in other reports as Victoria Berry, admitted to having sex with Crane on two occasions. On October 31, 1994, Carpenter, then 66 years old, was found not guilty. The Beckley Register Herald quoted the jury foreman as saying, "You can't prove someone guilty on speculation." Here's Carol Ford.
He maintained his innocence all throughout. For his whole life, he maintained his innocence. And the jury acquitted him. There just was not enough physical evidence. There was circumstantial evidence, but not, there was no physical evidence to back up the claims that he was, without any doubt, the one who killed Bob Crane. So they had to acquit. There was no way that they could have found him guilty.
Because of all the time that's passed, almost half a century, and because of the issues with any evidence that did remain, and since many witnesses and persons of interest have passed on, Carol said there's no official interest in the case.
And because the evidence box has been released to the estate, it's all tainted now. You know, none of it can ever be entered because it's been handled now by myself. I sat there and looked through it all. So, 1978 was a while ago, and as far as solving it, the Scottsdale Police Department will always maintain that John Carpenter was the one that did it. They have closed it. It's marked unsolved, but there isn't any effort, or I shouldn't say effort, but there isn't any interest to reopen it.
In an interesting turn, Bob's business manager was later charged with embezzling from Bob. I asked why he was not considered a suspect.
I think they looked at him briefly, but again, he was not in Scottsdale. He had an alibi. But where he figures into the picture is that because of the focus now on Bob Crane, they're turning his life upside down. They're looking at everything. They're examining his whole life at this point. And this is where it comes to light that Lloyd Vaughn was his name, is his name. He's still alive. But it came to light that he had been embezzling. That was one of the reasons why Bob was on the road so much. Bob was constantly working because the money wasn't there. And part of the reason why the money wasn't there was because Lloyd Vaughn was skimming off the top and embezzling.
It wasn't discovered that he was embezzling until after Bob was killed. So any money that Bob was making was really only helping him anyway.
With the extensive research and interviews that they've done, I asked biographers Linda Groundwater and Carol Ford who they thought killed Bob Crane.
The thing is that we do have our own theories, and they did change from time to time, and we've now kind of settled on one. But we try, as Bob's biographers, to keep our opinion out of it because it may skew the way people look at the objective facts of what we have written and what we continue to do on Bob's behalf. Everything now is just a theory. And unless somebody steps forward with a deathbed confession, if they haven't already died, there is not really going to be an answer.
Although Carol and Linda won't say who they think killed Bob Crane, I did ask them if we'd discuss the person they suspect.
There are so many theories that it's in there somewhere, sure.
Bob Crane was a talented actor, and there's no telling how far his already stellar career would have gone. Carol and Linda said that Bob should not be remembered for the way he died. They want to remember Bob for his love of life.
Bob's true legacy is laughter, is interest in learning, is joy in life. Very interested in giving to his friends. But to Bob, being able to connect with people was his greatest interest, his greatest love, despite his addiction. It's go on and keep going, keep learning, keep loving, keep laughing. He was the man who always believed there was a pony in the other room.
About a week before he died, he was talking with a reporter in Scottsdale, and he said to that reporter, "If I were to write my autobiography, I would title it Laughing All the Way to the Grave." It's who Bob was. He wanted to bring, and he did bring, joy to millions, through Hogan's Heroes. You know, that show still runs today around the world. People love Hogan's Heroes. It's coming up on its 60th anniversary next year. It'll be 60 years since that show premiered. And to this day, I mean, that's a long time. That's a long time to have a show remain as popular as it has remained.
There may never be a conclusive answer to who killed Bob Crane, partly because it appears the critical evidence of the blood stain and possible brain matter was not preserved, which could have been compelling proof that would have either included or excluded Carpenter. But there could still be someone out there who has information, a clue that could bring closure to the case and resolution to Bob's family and his fans. You can read more about Bob's career and his life in the biography by Carol Ford and Linda Groundwater called Bob Crane, The Definitive Biography. You can also visit their website, where they continue to petition the Radio Hall of Fame to include Bob. We have links to all of this information and more on our website, along with photos and blog at apbcoldcase.com.
Thanks for listening to APB Cold Case. Tell us about your cold case at apbcoldcase@spawngroup.com. APB Cold Case is an original Spawn Group production.